Well, hello everyone. Thank you for joining us wherever you're watching this, whenever you're watching this. It's a great privilege for me to be bringing you the next installment in our We Follow series, and I get the awesome privilege to be speaking to you on a subject called the Six Woes to the Pharisees. It's a quite a famous passage, probably. And when I first got this passage, I actually chose this passage. I had like a thought in my mind, or a way that I was going to speak about this passage. I had in mind who I was going to be speaking it to, with my own, ideas of what kind of a Pharisee might look like in today's world and certain people that hold certain views. But what I've actually learned from studying this passage, from preparing this, is actually we all have the potential to have a Pharisaic attitude, to act like a Pharisee, and to think like a Pharisee. So there are some ways in life where I am quite narrow-minded. I'm quite stuck in my ways. I'm not willing to branch out into other possibilities. And a few of those ways is food, and particularly when it comes to like takeaway food. So, for example, KFC. I will always order a boneless banquet when I go to KFC. There is no other option that I will pick. It's always going to be the boneless banquet. When I go to Subway, I will always select a foot-long Italian BMT with red onions, olives, sweet corn, and peppers with barbecue sauce. That is all I have ever ordered. And when I order Domino's, I will always order a barbecue-based meteor. I am not going to order anything else. And I also hold some unpopular opinions, and these are just my opinions, and I'm glad I'm going to be saying these over a camera and not in real life. But one of those unpopular opinions is that Star Wars is one of the worst movie franchises ever created. Now, I know that I can just sense people now through the lens that they're going to be angry at me. They've got their remote controls, maybe their Star Wars figures that they're going to want to throw at me. But it's just my unpopular opinion that Star Wars is one of the worst movie franchises out there, and I'm not at the moment willing to open up the possibility of myself to change my mind on that. But one thing I have changed my mind on over the years is coffee. Now, there was a time pre-May 2015 where I didn't like coffee. I didn't really like the smell. I didn't know what the fuss was about. I certainly didn't like the taste until I was introduced to it and I was told, have a caramel latte and get used to it that way. And that's what I did. And over the months, I became more and more conditioned to love coffee. I was opened up to the world of coffee. And now, 5 years on, I would, class myself probably as a coffee snob. That is a category that I would put myself in. I love going out for coffee. I love meeting up with people because it often involves coffee. I love going to posh coffee houses. It was something that I changed my mind on. And today, as we think about Jesus' encounter with the Pharisees from the Bible, we might have this perception of them that these were kinds of people that didn't change their minds. They were very narrow-minded in the way that they thought. And as we think about today's world, we might naturally class some people as quite Pharisaic, or they would be in the Pharisee realms of living. Maybe we could be thinking of like Donald Trump, a great person that we go to, I don't, a great person we often turn to take the mickey out of. Maybe it's Piers Morgan. We often don't like what he says. We can often sometimes think maybe, well, he's quite Pharisaic. Well, what maybe even about certain leaders or elders of a church, of a certain church denomination? Maybe we think, well, they're quite Pharisees for holding certain theological views. What about Greta Thunberg? What about her and her militant pursuit of everyone turning green? What about Extinction Rebellion, a group of people that are urging us to follow a certain code of conduct? What about me? Would you class me as a Pharisee? Because once upon a time at university, I was known as the Pharisee. I was once called the Pharisaic pig for being part of a church that held similar theological views to Barton and theological views that overall I would hold to as well. But when I was at that church, I was once labelled the controversial one. Which I kind of think they're implying that I could be potentially liberal. So what am I? Am I a Pharisee or am I a liberal? And even today I can see people as I talk to them, as I let them know who I listen to when it comes to worship music, who I listen to when it comes to like certain preachers, how I think about certain things, how I act in certain situations, that people move me up and down the liberal Pharisee spectrum. And to be honest, I don't really care about that. I've never really cared about, you know, what people have said about that. I kind of wear it as a badge of honor, and I don't know if I should, but I kind of do sometimes. And today I don't really care where you sit on the theological or political spectrum. Today what I want really care about is that you know that everyone has the potential, wherever they sit on the spectrum, theologically or politically, to think like a Pharisee, act like a Pharisee, and have an attitude like a Pharisee. So we're going to be looking at the six woes to the Pharisees today. Leading up to this, Jesus was driven out a demon. The crowds have been increasing because of what is happening. Jesus compares himself to Jonah. And then Jesus moves the conversation on by urging people that are listening to make sure that their life, their eyes, their body is full of light and not darkness. And with Jesus being the definition of light, and with his encounter that he's about to have with the Pharisees, what he's about to expose is something, you know, that's happening in the dark. And light always exposes what is happening in the dark. Light always exposes what is happening in the dark. Which brings us to the six woes. But what is a woe? Okay, we hear it, you know, there's some woes in Isaiah, there's woes in the Gospels. But basically, a woe is a cry for God's judgment in light of action that deserves a divine response. So it's quite a serious thing that Jesus is coming to the Pharisees and saying, woe. He's saying the way that you are acting, the way you are living, it needs a divine response. And for too long, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law have been transitioning their ideology silently and effectively through the generations. In doing so, they have maintained the status quo. They've maintained their positions of power and social status, of wealth. But in doing so, they've also heaped monumental burden upon people who are trying to live for God. For too long, they've been building this bridge over their head to protect themselves. And he's about to challenge their views. He's about to challenge their attitudes and practices. And what the Pharisees are about to experience is that when Jesus tests those views, when he tests those attitudes and practices, it hurts when it comes falling down upon you. Which brings us to the actual passage today, which is in Luke 11, and the passage is 37 to 54. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to read out section by section, so I won't read it all out in one chunk. So first of all, we're going to start verse 37 to 41. When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. So he went in and reclined at the table. But the Pharisee was surprised when he noticed that Jesus did not first wash before the meal. Then the Lord said to him, "Now then, you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people, did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But now, as for what is inside of you, be generous to the poor, and everything will be clean for you." Now, I don't know what the Pharisee's intention was inviting Jesus in for some food, but what we're about to see and what the Pharisees are about to realize is that they are going to regret doing it. But who are these Pharisees? If you've been in church for a while, you've probably have this perception of what they look like and what they stand for. They don't have a very good reputation in church. And if there's any a group of people that Christians, and myself included, feel like they can take a free shot at, swipe at, condemn, criticize, and scrutinize, it would be this group of people. And we don't often feel bad when doing it. But the Pharisees, they were a religious party, and if they were around today, we would call them a pressure group within a political sphere. They held strong political beliefs, which were backed up by religious sanctions, and their rules were designed to help make people keep the Jewish law. And they were a group of people who took it upon themselves to urge people to obey a certain kind of code of conduct. And as we go through today, what I want us to realize, what I want you to realize, is that the gospel confronts all strongly held agendas. The gospel confronts all strongly held agendas. Now, Jesus is about to go six rounds with the Pharisees, and I'm using this boxing analogy, but what kicks it off is that Jesus notices that the Pharisee noticed and was surprised that Jesus didn't wash his hands, or didn't wash at all, maybe, I don't know. But if there was ever a time to get our heads around cleansing rituals, about washing, if there was ever a time for Christians to read the book of Leviticus, today is the day. This is the season to read it. Suddenly, there's some context. We can have like some actual personal context of what it means to keep a certain distance in certain times when you've got certain symptoms, when it means washing your hands after doing certain things. Like, we should be understanding that. So we could kind of think that we could excuse the Pharisees to expect Jesus to wash in this, you know, before eating lunch or dinner or whatever it was. But Jesus is warming up for round one, and he does this on purpose to get them, like, get it started. This is just like kind of the warm-up act. And he's making the point very clear that for too long the Pharisees have been maintaining the outside of their look, maintaining their outside look appearance of having a perfect relationship with God, that they were the way to live like God, that to be like them would be to be the way God wanted them to be. But as Jesus says, for too long they've been doing that. But inside, even though the outside looks good, inside, verse 39, is full of greed and wickedness. And Jesus is not condemning physical cleanliness, because actually washing hands, washing in general, you know, doesn't hurt anyone. But what he is saying and what he is reacting to is that the Pharisees have elevated physical cleanliness above the cleanliness of the heart. And what Jesus wants them to know and for us to know is that Jesus cares for the heart the most, or God cares for the heart the most. And because for so many centuries they have not changed, this institution, the Pharisaic institution hasn't really changed, he hits them with the six woes, which brings us to verse 42, which says this: "Woe to you, Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kinds of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone." Now, in the Old Testament, there was all these kinds of tithes, from the big to the small, to the obvious, to the secret. And the Pharisees were so caught up in showing their faithfulness to God by, tithing their mint, their coriander, parsley, I don't know what they were tithing. They were so caught up in tithing the tiny, tiny, small things. What they actually forgot and neglected was justice and the love for the poor. And what Jesus is saying is, if you're going to do it, do both, okay? Don't neglect one for the other. And if I was, if I do say so myself, God would rather you care for justice than worry about your tithing. That's just my personal opinion. And Jesus actually starts off easy here. He actually gives them an alternative way to live. Like, okay, yes, do that, but do this also. What we're going to see is the next five woes are just plain woe, which brings us to round two, which starts in verse 43. "Woe to you, Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogues and respectful greetings in the marketplace." So within this religion of Judaism, there were many elaborate greetings for the rabbis and the Pharisees. And these elaborate greetings would, special seats in the synagogues would naturally draw attention to them. They would naturally draw to their status, their maybe their wealth and their power within the town or the city. And they wanted people to know that. But what Jesus is saying, look, even like, I'm the Son of God, but I don't want those places. I want us to be humble. And that is the way to go about it. Status is not a thing to thrive on if you want to follow God. Which brings us to round three, which starts in verse 44. "Woe to you, because you are like unmarked graves, which people walk over without knowing it." Now, this one's a bit more complicated, but basically what Jesus is signaling to is he's signaling to the uncleanliness and death that was within their hearts. So just as the Pharisees were like, "Well, Jesus, mate, you didn't clean before eating dinner. You didn't wash your hands." What he's saying is actually, okay, I might not have cleaned, my hands on the outside, but my heart is clean. And what he's saying to the Pharisees is actually, your heart is full of uncleanliness and death. It's full of greed and wickedness. Now, that brings us to verse 45. "One of the experts in the law answered him, 'Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us also.'" So now it's 2 versus 1. It's Jesus versus the Pharisees and the experts in the law. It's two institutions versus Jesus. But who are these experts in the law? The experts in the law, it was a learned profession. They were a group of people that were attempting to codify as much of the Jewish law as possible. They were working out really complex possibilities of situations that might arise, which they would then need to answer and tell people to do the right thing in that kind of situation. And they didn't intentionally set up to do this. They didn't do it for the fun of it. They didn't make it complicated just to watch people try and, struggle through life. And they took God's law very, very seriously. So they said, now Jesus is taking on two major institutions, which brings us to round 4, which starts in verse 46. Jesus replied, "And you experts in the law, woe to you, because you load people down with burdens they can hardly carry, and yourselves will not lift one finger to help them." Now, this word burden is originally translated in Greek fortune, which is a word used to describe a ship's cargo. And because of all these codes and hoops that these experts in the law have created, Jesus accuses them of loading people down with burden heavy as cargo, which they can hardly carry. And Jesus even says, "You yourselves will not even lift one fingertip to help them. You make all these rules, all these hoops to jump through, and you just watch them try and do it. You don't even get alongside them. You don't even give them a helping hand in trying to live like the way you have created, you know, by the laws you've created them to live by." Which brings us to round 5, which is verse 47 to 51. "Woe to you, because you build tombs for the prophets, and it was your ancestors who killed them. So you testify that you approve of what your ancestors did. They killed the prophets, and you build their tombs. Because of this, God in his wisdom said, 'I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill, and others they will persecute.' Therefore, this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world. From the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who was killed between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, this generation will be held responsible for it all." So basically, it's quite literal in what he says. He's basically saying that their ancestors were literally killing and persecuting the prophets that God gave them. And they were building tombs to honor these prophets. But at the same time, they would kill and persecute these prophets by their interpretation of the law. Which brings us to the final round, which is in verse 52. "Woe to you experts in the law, because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering." The experts of the law, they assumed that they were the way to God. They held the key to all knowledge in how to get to him. But instead of doing that, what they actually did was they put up barriers. And actually through them, no one has found God. And even though they think they found God, even though they think they hold the key to it, not even they have found him. And this is a knockout blow. Jesus has gone for it, and they have gone in for the defense. Because as we read in verse 53 and 54, the Pharisees and experts of the law have had enough of what he's saying. They've heard enough. They've heard enough truth, and it's hurting them. And it goes like this. "When Jesus went outside, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say." So both groups have had enough. They've been winded by the truth, and they begin their defense by verse 53, opposing him fiercely and to besiege him with questions. Now this word besiege literally means they were surrounding him and harassing him. And both groups, they laid in waiting, verse 54, to catch him in something he might say. And this language is similarly used for a hunt. And suddenly Jesus is the prey. But the hunters will soon find themselves shooting themselves in their own foot. So what can we actually learn from this encounter that Jesus had? What we can learn is an obsessive pursuit of right can lead to some very serious wrong. An obsessive pursuit of right can lead to some very serious wrong. Now, as I said at the beginning, Christians, in my opinion, myself included, feel like we can have a free shot at the Pharisees. And I think what we need to do as we think about the Pharisees, if we go kind of through the Gospels and all that kind of stuff, is actually not everyone was like this. And actually, these were faithful people that wanted to be faithful to God's law. And we do have to realize that we have the benefit of hindsight. Often it's too easy to go, oh, you silly Pharisees, how on earth, you stupid people, how on earth could you think that the law meant this when actually it meant that? But we can do that because we have hindsight. So even though we can probably cut them some slack in some things, maybe there are some things that they should, you know, have been aware of, and they should have, been put in check with, and that is their attitude. And through life, there have been times with my journey with God that I have been, and even now actually, there are times where I have a Pharisaic attitude, where I become militant and become obsessive in the pursuit of a certain value or a certain way of living or a certain way of doing things, which caused me to condemn people, to be maybe arrogant, and just leave other people's opinion to themselves, and I'm not going to take that opinion on. There was times when I was at university and sometime after where I had this view that it was impossible to be conservative, politically conservative, and Christian. I don't know what it was, but within my theology that I had created, that I had surrounded myself with, I had it in myself to say that it was impossible to be a Christian and vote conservative. It just didn't match up to my theology. And when it came to Brexit, which was, you know, quite lately, I held a strong view that it was near impossible to be a Christian and vote to leave the EU. Again, my head just couldn't get around it. My theology that I built around myself, my values, my opinions, which I built to protect myself, to uphold maybe a certain status within myself, would not allow that possibility to happen. And something that I'm quite strong about now, and something that God is working, working on me at the moment, and something that, divides opinion across the world maybe, and that is worship style and volume levels. For me, I had this view that to connect with God, it needs to be this kind of worship music. It needs to be for this length of time. It needs to be this kind of volume level, because that is the best way to connect with God. And if we are not doing that, then we are not optimizing our connectivity with God. And what God said to me, or kind of showed me, is actually, Ross, that is maybe one of the ways that you best connect with me, but it's not the best way for everyone else necessarily. And that was a hard thing to kind of learn from God. And again, as I said at the beginning, the gospel confronts all strongly held agendas. I'm not saying that you shouldn't hold a view. I think you should hold views on many, many things. I think you should hold opinions, because often it's those views that inform our everyday life. It informs our thoughts and actions and how we interact with one another. But what I am saying is that strongly held views should be held humbly. Strongly held views should be held humbly, because if you and I are not careful about what we believe, about what we hold true, about our opinions and our agendas, what we might find very, very quickly is a Pharisaic attitude is easy to slip into when we don't humbly rely on God. It's easy to slip into that attitude when we don't humbly rely on God. Because following Jesus is not relying on our views and our opinions. It's relying on Him. Following Jesus, not holding fast to our opinions, it's holding fast to Him. And following Jesus isn't fighting for what we want. It's fighting for what Jesus wants. You and I, we build our lives around views, agendas, ideologies and theologies. It's a bridge that goes over our head to protect ourselves from people we don't agree with, actions we don't agree with, thoughts we don't agree with. And that's okay, because bridges don't actually box us in. But if you are a follower of Jesus, what we build out over our heads will be tested by the gospel. What we build over our heads will be tested by the gospel. Any view that you hold, any agenda, attitude, theology, when it's tested by the gospel, how painful is it going to be if Jesus comes along and tests it? How much of your pride is going to be dented? Because in my experience, being humbled is a painful experience. It's not something that you naturally want to run towards. but it's a painful experience. It was only when I started finding out that the people I loved the most, the people I was closest to, the people that I admired the most for their faith in God, for their prayerfulness, for their servant-heartedness, for their passionate pursuit of justice and their passionate pursuit of God, that it would be voting opposite to me, that they would be totally opposite to what I believe in my opinions and my agendas, that God showed me that it was possible to be a Christian and vote Conservative, that it was possible to vote Brexit and still follow God in a loving, humble way, to still want justice for all. And my pride was dented because suddenly I had to suck it up, that I couldn't remain on this pedestal of spouting out my views of what I think God would want. Because the freedom Jesus purchased us on the cross, he didn't just take away the punishment we deserve. He also allowed us to be able to prayerfully, freely vote for who we want to, knowing that God is in control, even if everything sometimes doesn't feel like it. That actually we can worship God in any way we want, and we're all made differently, and we all connect with God in different ways. We all listen to different speakers. We all listen to different music, because that's okay, because God has created us in so many ways where we need different kinds of things. We need different views and opinions. So to finish practically, from rounds 4, 6, and you know, like the harassment of Jesus, this is the first one. The God lover is not a finger pointer, but a hand helper. If you're going to hold a view or attitude, help people understand your view in a humble and loving way. And if you're in a position of power and influence, which most of us are, I do believe that everyone has some influence, help people walk in that view. And if you notice yourself pointing that finger over an issue that you're not happy about, be that with church, work, family, friends, that is the reminder to open the rest of your fingers to give a helping hand. Sometimes we need to stop, pause and think, could it be that the issue that I'm not happy about, the issue that I am militant about, the way that it makes me feel, is actually not their fault, but actually my fault. It's my baggage or your baggage that you are holding yourself that's making you think about certain things a certain way. 2. Sometimes best intentions do the opposite. If you're going to hold a view or attitude, hold that view lovingly, openly and humbly, but holding it strongly and close, who knows that there may be a risk that instead your best intentions are actually doing the opposite. Your best motives are actually putting up barriers, and your passionate pursuit of what you think is right, which is often what we want, could actually be causing harm and division. And finally, don't be the neighbourhood meerkat. Don't be the neighbourhood meerkat. We've all got them in our neighbourhoods. We've all got them in our streets. When something is happening, when someone comes down the drive, or when someone comes to your house, does something, drops something off, they peek up out the window, they look around, wondering. They're like the neighbourhood meerkat. If you're going to hold a viewer attitude, don't pop up like that meerkat. When you hear something you don't like, don't lie in waiting, ready to harass, besiege those that hold opposite views and attitudes to you. Don't wait for them to say something which will fuel the fire that you might accidentally be building. Instead, humbly, lovingly engage in meaningful and intentional, God-honoring, God-glorifying conversation. And with everything that you hold, with your best intentions, with all the good that you hope you are doing for God's glory and for his kingdom building, allow God and the gospel to humbly confront anything that you are holding on tight to.